We've come to the point now where you were a dealer in on Jimmy Bisgood's book in the Motors Market. Could I ask you to describe what a typical day would have been like for you at this time?
Yes, I suppose typical day was a pretty early start. Then up to the office to make sure there was nothing left out from the overnight positions, just to confirm that we had got those right. And then we'd get our books and we'd go to the stock exchange. Jimmy might, as the partner in charge, be down there. He may be in the office. But generally speaking, we picked up the books, and there were quite a lot of books, and all the blue buttons and dealers would go down to the market and set ourselves up on the pitch, get ourselves sort of ship shape, and wait for the people to come in. I would, at that stage, well, we had a senior member as well as Jimmy Bisgood on the book, and so I was the junior. So we sort of shared a blue button at that stage because I was the junior, and so I did most of the donkey work, and the other two did most of the dealing. But as I gradually got into the thing, I started to look after some of the stocks myself, and gradually got to know the stocks. And then once I knew them, Jimmy Bisgood seemed to take less of a role and let us get on with it. And Tim Braz was very much the same. And eventually, after a period of time, Tim Braz actually went off to do something else. I think he went on to fixed interest or something, which left just Jimmy and I and a blue button. And then as things progressed after that, the two of us ran that book. And finally, after two or three years, Jimmy finally said, well, you know, I think you better get on with it now. And very much a case of handing on to younger people all the time, which I think is what our company, you know, throughout the firm. And so I was left with it. Then I had a dealer with me. And then we acquired another blue button. And we increased the stocks on that book from just the motors to components. And Jimmy was the sort of father figure overlooking everything. And it just sort of traded on day by day.
Yes. Would you stop for lunch at some point during the day?
We had lunch, but we never stopped trading. I mean, unlike, say, the Irish exchange, where they went off their Guinness and you couldn't get them from, say, 12 to 2. No, nothing stopped in the London Stock Exchange. It all went on, and if we were too busy for lunch, we wouldn't go to lunch. And you'd snatch a half an hour now and again. But when things were slack, one always took an hour and a bit, you know. So, no, we didn't... We never closed.
And was the routine each day more or less the same?
Yes, very much the same. Some days, of course, with the international news or company news generally, there was a lot more running around and so on. But basically, every day on the stock exchange is different. I have to tell you that every day is different because you're seeing people in different moods, and there's always some excitement. There's a buzz in the market, or there was a buzz in the market. So it was never boring. It wasn't like being a bank clerk. I mean, you were physically there on the exchange. You were speaking to people. It was all quite exciting. It made the adrenaline flow.
Mm. And what time would you leave the house at the end of the day?
3:30. Cigarettes were allowed at 3 o'clock, so everybody lit up then. And for my sins, I used to smoke as well. You could only stand it for half an hour. I mean, it was in closed space. And so we smoked from 3 to 3:30. Then we left the house about 20 to 4, dealing on the phones. And then we go upstairs. The books would be sent up first, and then, you know, we'd have a sort of standby in the house and a chap in the office so there was no breakdown in communication. And then we would go on dealing at our desks as we were dealing in the house, but obviously on telephones.
Why was it necessary to continue dealing after hours?
Well, I don't know if it was necessary, but the fact of the matter was people wanted to deal, and so we would deal. I mean, in theory, one could deal all weekend if you want, and I on some Saturdays I had dealt with people. There are international stocks that people dealt in. No, I mean, you can deal any time. The only restriction, which is still in force today, is that you can't deal in a new issue until the day of that issue, and it used to be the off was 9 o'clock. I think the off still is. No, 9:30. Now the off is 9 o'clock. Now, of course, there is a grey market that you can officially deal in, but those stocks that are actually officially quoted on the stock exchange, and you as members cannot deal until that day.
Mm. And about what time would you head home at the end of the day?
I suppose we used to. I mean, of course, it was all pen and booking physical then. I mean, there was no technology as such, and so we were pretty late actually trying to agree our positions every night, and I suppose on quiet days you might get away about 6, 6:30, but in busier times when you had big runs on the motorbook, we could be there till 8, 9 o'clock at night. And we did have one particular partner who was an absolute stickler for finding the last share. I mean, he would never write anything off. And I mean, I know that I've been there till 10 o'clock one night trying to find 500 shares, absolutely daft. And
what was exactly involved in agreeing your positions?
Well, we had a thing called the green sheets, which would be now the equivalent of my daily runoff. And those green sheets, we had to work out the bull and bear positions of every stock throughout our books. We had to make sure that we had our cash worked out, so we knew what the exposure was. We had to make sure that all the checking queries for that day had been closed and there was nothing outstanding, at least nothing out there that we could put right. But it was mostly reconciling the positions. Well, I say there's no technology. Obviously, we had a back office that had comptometers and some form of technology, but that was a sort of mechanised bookkeeping as opposed to our real-time accounting that we have now. And so, yes, there was a master copy, which was a series of printed bargain records. And consequently, at times, you had to add up pages of these things, you know, and pages of the jobbing books. And actually, I mean, as everybody was writing things in jobbing books during the day, and it was fairly hectic, some of the writing could be very difficult to decipher, and I suppose if you were asking somebody else in my company, they'd have said, oh, well, mine was the worst. It still is, I'm afraid, but it just took a long time. It was real donkey work, you know.
Would you have other people, outsiders, coming into the office after hours?
Brokers? Well, no, the people that used to come out, I mean, certainly not brokers, although, I mean, if friends came in, that was one thing, but what we used to have was the newspapers, and there was a chap called Shalliday, who we all remember with much affection. He was the Financial Times market reporter, and he would come up and he'd walk around all the desks asking for any features during the day and turnovers and things like that, and swap stories, and he came up every day. And then other people might pop in from the newspapers, but a lot of those newspapers captured some of the market people on the curb as we left the market. Mm. And they had the sort of, I don't know, 10-minute, quarter of an hour rundown with them before we got to the office. But Shalliday was the one that really mattered. He was... The newspapers weren't quite as sophisticated as they are now. Now everybody has an absolute marvellous daily column, a market report. Then it was only the FT that really had it. I mean, there was a mention, but it was nothing like today's stuff. Mm-hmm.
Would you find yourself physically tired at the end of the day?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was... It was a long journey and there was a lot of rushing about during the day. I think particularly at our end of it, where you were the junior for most of that time, because you were dealing and you were also running. And then you were working, you know, so you had physical exertion and certainly mental exertion. It was pretty tough going. It was pretty tough going. There were some boom periods when I was at Bisgood at very early days. Yes, it was a long day.
Yes. Could you refer to some of those boom periods?
Well, there was the Ford takeover that was on and off for many, many months and probably years, and lots of speculation arose in that one. There was a lot of business in the British Motor Corporation, that is to say Roots Motors, before they were all merged. A lot of business in Leyland, a lot of business in Guy Motors. These are names that are probably gone forever, but lots of speculation in some of those things, and consequently very great increase in bargains booked. And we also had a reasonable amount of new issue business. I can't actually think of the new issues at the time, but I mean, that would be easy to look back on. But on a new issue day, it was very hectic. I mean, they would come in a horde of people would just sort of converge on the pitch. And although they were competing market mode, competing jobbers, you all had a big, big crowd around you, and people expected you to deal very fast. I mean, half a dozen bargains at a time, somebody else booking them, you doing them. It was an exhausting day, yes, but fun. I mean, I don't think one felt overtired, but I mean, at that time, you did have your girlfriends to go out with after hours, and you did have a social life, or you tried to, and it wasn't easy to get away, even on special occasions. You know, it was a long day. It was a very long day, but as I say, terribly rewarding in satisfaction terms, and pretty rewarding at the end of the year, had it, you know, when it is good. I mean, I think bonuses then meant a lot more than they mean now. People take everything as a right now that you should get a bonus. But, I mean, one didn't know until the year end you know, jobbers, you could lose £1 million as well as make £1 million. So you might have had a jolly good run, and then the last month you might lose the lot. And of course, you were on tender, you didn't know what you would get. And bonuses were a big occasion, and it was a lot of money, you know. It was a lot of money. I mean, if one was getting, well, I can't even remember the figures now, but if one was getting, say, £2,000 a year, to get a bonus of £300 or £400 was hell of a big boost. I mean, you really felt you were on top of the world. I mean, it was marvellous, absolutely marvellous.
Now, how did your career progress? You'd got to the point where you were an authorised clerk and you could deal.
Yeah, and then from my, let me see, 53 blue button, I became a member in 66, and then I became a partner in 67.
Now, what did becoming a member involve?
Well, you do your trial period on a book, and the people assess you to see whether you're what they want and whether you know what you're doing. And then you aspire to becoming a member. I mean, I have to say that to become a member then was quite something. I mean, it wasn't easy to become a member, and certainly without any particular background. I mean, you had reached a rung on the ladder. I mean, it was, well, I don't know if anybody felt that way, but I must say I felt very cock-a-hoop, and it was a terrific achievement. I felt very, though I say to myself, I felt very proud of myself that I'd done it, you know. And I sort of went away, or around in a sort of daze for a while, thinking, this is marvellous, isn't it? Anyhow, that you get that, and then you are, whereas as an authorised clerk you could do most things, you were restricted in the amount of shares you could deal in, size, and lots of other things. Although you were authorised to deal, you weren't really authorised to make major decisions. Whereas when you became a member, one below the partnership, you had a lot more authority. You weren't allowed to commit the company to outrageous exposures. And anyway, good manners dictated that you would speak to the guy in charge of the book. We weren't so plucky, we weren't so cocky as people are today, you know. I think we feared for our jobs, really. I mean, we were employees. Most people today feel that you couldn't do without them. It's a much different attitude to everything, I think. But anyhow, that was no bad thing. It was a good discipline, and so one jobbed along as you did before, but you're a little bit more senior, a little bit more respect from people, and then the next step was to become a partner.
And how did that come about?
Well, it usually came about in jobbing and broking firms in those days, because the present partnership would want to create probably a cessation for tax purposes, which allowed a partner to go out and one to come in, then you claw back a lot of tax. The detrimental effect on that, on the individual coming in, was usually you came in and you were in the red. The guy going out did very nicely, thank you very much, and fair dues, that was the price for getting in, but you were in the red, and probably for some years. And although the firms, by and large, would allow you to have, well, you'd have your salary, and they allow you to draw some bonus, most of the bonus was ploughed back in to get you into the black. The fact of the matter was that you were delighted to be aboard. I mean, you really were on the ladder then. And it was just sort of dedication and hard work after that to work yourself through up to the partnership and higher and higher and so on.
Were there others who'd started with you in the firm at more or less the same time who didn't make it through to being a member or a partner?
Well, there were one or two other people. Certainly, I remember a chap that came in after me became a partner before me, and he was older. He hadn't done as much as myself, but he was brought in on a different basis. He was brought in as true management potential, if you like, whereas I was working my way up from zero to something. This fellow had been in industry. And although I felt a little bit annoyed that somebody had overtaken me, the fact of the matter, he was older than me, the fact of the matter, he had experience, and one couldn't be silly about it. But for my contemporaries, when I got authorised, he and I, this other man who should be nameless, we got taken into the partnership virtually at the same time, slightly different levels, but my contemporaries didn't come along for 2 or 3 years afterwards. I mean, what they didn't do in those days, they didn't sort of create partnerships en masse. The people in it were not reluctant to go, but they could bide their time. They could go when they wanted to go. It was a very relaxed sort of partnership for most people. And it wasn't terribly hard. I mean, a lot of those chaps in those days, I mean, I wouldn't have them working for me because it's much more professional these days. But it was very much like being a member of the club, and you just bade your time and you went when you felt like going, really.
Did your daily routine change in any way?
I don't think it did, to be perfectly honest. I mean, obviously, I didn't carry the books anymore, and I could get straight to the house instead of going to the office, and one had delegated those things down the line. I think the way it changed was that you had more responsibility. You had to show that you were more responsible, and there were things that you could opt out of as an authorised clerk, which you couldn't do as a partner.
What kind of things?
Well, unlike stockbroking, we still all mixed as a family. There was no them and us. There was no, sort of lines of communication where we were all on the floor together. We weren't like stockbrokers. Stockbrokers, they became, all of a sudden, they had their own office and they didn't speak to the oiks and so on. And it was never like that in jobbers. Even in the evenings, I mean, we still had open plan desks. The senior partner had his office, but even the senior partners were always on their desks. So very little change. But the other things were that you would expect to speak to other stockbrokers. You would probably go out to lunches with institutions. And you were representing the firm. I mean, I've always been a great believer that whoever works for whichever firm, they're wearing their badge morning, noon and night. It didn't matter whether you were around the pub or on the floor of the house, you're wearing that badge and you have to react responsibly. And no, nothing had changed. One became a bit more adult, a bit more senior, and tried to enhance the business, really.
Were you still working on the same book, the motor book?
Yes, I was, actually. Yes, I was still working on the same book. That went on for a long, long time. And in fact, it wasn't, because the trouble was, all those partners on the other books, I mean, they never wanted to move. I mean, they knew every day their routine. They knew what time their coffee was, they knew what time their lunch was. They were all fairly senior, and if anybody was away, one would have to double up on the jobs. I mean, they were never worried about them being away, but I mean, you had to be a bit careful about when you were away. I mean, you took your holidays and you attended when you had to attend. So yes, I always felt that, I mean, a bit daft really, but I suppose I've always felt that when you're the junior, you want to be there all the time to make sure you are there and do the job. And when you're in a responsible position, you say, well, God, you're so important, you've got to be there. And so it goes on. It's only in sort of later years I realise that the graveyards are full of indispensable people. But I suppose if you're keen on a job, you give it your all. And I still do, I'm glad to say.
Now, what I want to do is try and take you back to the floor of the house, as it were, and ask you if any particular events in the late 60s, early 70s figure in your memory in any way. The first is the devaluation in 1967, if you might remember. The pound fell from £2.80 to £2.40, and I believe the stock exchange was closed for the day after. Mm. Does that feature in your memory in any way?
To be perfectly honest, no. No, it doesn't. I vaguely remember it, and certainly I remember the stock exchange closing, but it didn't. I mean, it was, lots of those things are, they're really newspaper reports. You hear and you read what everybody has to say, and you read all the comments, and you come in, and the next day the basis of shares have changed, but you're still trading as you was trading. Not like a stockbroker that had to advise his clients to speak to his clients. The jobber was the man that lived by his wits, and it wouldn't matter that, if you like, that the pound was halved. The fact of the matter was that he had to do something about getting his positions right. And so it doesn't really feature in a big way. Yeah. Something that featured more than that was decimalisation. And I remember decimalisation, the run-up to that. I mean, you can't believe it now because, well, it's just extraordinary how we were all very worried that we'd never get used to tens. I mean, it seems crackers now, but there were people saying, oh, my God, that's going to be difficult. Of course, it was the easiest thing in the world. And what it did have, the effect that it had on the certainly on jobbers, was that overnight we increased our turns enormously. And it all seemed to fit in. And, you know, the only way I can ever think about how that added to our P&L was the fact that now, I mean, the other day I went to buy a packet of sweets and I said to the woman, do you realise that's five bob? I mean, that's here and now, but you couldn't have believed all those years ago that a small packet of sweets could ever cost five bob. But the devaluation of money allowed us to make much bigger turns on our business. Mm. And that was a big, big boost to us. And I think we probably took advantage of it because people didn't quite understand. I think we've been practicing what would happen for some weeks before. We found it very easy to go into that mode and we caught on very quickly. And then, of course, although people think they can't get used to it, very quickly, I mean, you've got used to decimalisation. You wonder how anybody knew pounds, shillings and pence. I mean, far too complicated. But it's like everything, isn't it? I mean, you'd think that computers were too complicated, but even the dimmest people can use computers in the end. I mean, it really is quite a simple thing. It's the fear of everything that is the worry. But certainly I remember that as a very big change in what we were doing. And the other thing, I mean, perhaps this is not what you're looking for, but I do remember this, the earlier days of the atmosphere of the house. I remember this business of this man coming into the gilt market occasionally, and the whole house erupting into the hallelujah chorus, and Jerusalem, and fantastic, like a choir filling a cathedral. Everybody sang Jerusalem, you know, and this man, he only had to appear, and they burst into song. And there were other occasions like that where, I mean, people would muck about and shout out 1400 if the a member had come in they hadn't seen in years. You know, that was always the call, 1400 stranger in the house. And even those silly days, we had people would walk through the stock exchange and the waiters would come round and grab hold of them and march them out, and everybody would crowd round and hiss and boo them and so on. And yeah, well, lots of fun. And the lots of characters in the way of waiters that used to be at the stands that would call. I mean, that was the sort of intercom system, if you like. If you wanted somebody, you'd go over to a particular stand, which was nominated his stand. There was this great long board of numbers, and the man would, you'd say, I wanted, say, let's see, Lang and Cruikshank. And he would put up number 32, whatever Lang's number was, and then he'd shout out over the market, Lang and Cruikshank. And chap put his hand up and come over to the stand, and that's how he did it. And then if he was speaking to another stand, he'd blow down one of these blowpipes that he used to have in merchant, or at least navy. Mm. And this blowpipe would come off the other end of the house, and he'd say, is there a Lang down there? They'd shout down there, and it was quite extraordinary. And as I say, the other thing was these people walking around with the watering cans, keeping the dust down. There's a lot of hijinks with people lighting tapers in people's collars, and the other one was always when we were bored, somebody would get these little paper figures which they'd cut out and they'd put on somebody's head, and the whole market would start hissing and booing, and they'd be doing it to somebody else other than the fellow that had it on. Of course, he never knew, and they'd follow the other chap, and this fellow would walk out in the street and they'd really give him a laugh as he went out the door, you know. It was all nonsense, really, but it filled up the days. And the flicking of aeroplanes, and all sounds a bit childish, really. And we got slightly worried about that, as I remember when they opened the public galleries, thinking, you know, we better behave ourselves. But it didn't make much difference. You didn't really worry about the galleries after a while. It's all part of the atmosphere. Mm.
Does the move from the old house to the new stock exchange feature in any way?
Well, we remember it. I mean, what I particularly remember about that was the day we all packed up, and we saw all the scavengers came to get their mementos, and we virtually pulled the place to bits. I suppose, really, if anything, I was a little bit naive or perhaps too junior to... No, that's not fair, not too junior, perhaps. I was a little reluctant to pull the place to bits, but people did. And I suppose, for that reason, I don't have any mementos that a lot of other people got hold of. But certainly, there was a lot of that went on, and... it was a sad day, and we sort of finished the day by all banging like mad on the desks and the seats, and it was a sad day, really. But a memorable day. I mean, it really was a memorable day, and And we were sad to lose the old house. And then, of course, we got into these very cramped conditions of the temporary house. But very quickly, I mean, you get used to it. But it was a sort of cut off from the old to the new. And whatever sort of walk of life you're in, when things do change their environment, they naturally change the people, the habits, and what you did before you didn't do, either because you were constricted by space or people felt that they turn over a new leaf. Even the surroundings were modern and didn't lend themselves to the sort of atmosphere we'd had before. And it was a nasty shock to the system, I think.
One other sort of nitty-gritty question, the Rolls-Royce, collapse of Rolls-Royce in early 71. Now, yes. you were on the motorbook.
Yes.
Now, does that figure in any way?
Well, it was like a lot of other falls from grace, if you like, Guy Motors and Atkinson Lorris and things like that, the same sort of pattern emerged. But with Rolls-Royce, you had this enormous amount of business where everybody was a seller, certainly, but then when they got down to virtually nothing, all the Americans were buying, there was always this business of picking up option money stock. Huge turnovers in those. The absolute disbelief that something like Rolls-Royce could go bust. I mean, it just didn't make sense. And in point of fact, Rolls-Royce is still there, as you know, and it was resurrected and it was a lame duck and it was this, that and the other. And of course, the Americans made a vast amount of money. They were buying hundreds and millions of shares for sort of 3 farthings for a bunch of shares. And in the end, there was something to be got out of the receivership of that company. But I remember very well thinking, God, this is the end of the world. You know, it's and that's happened twice in my career, actually. The other time was when, and I remember this very painfully in 74, that I had been investing some money personally. And we were all sort of thinking, well, this is Armageddon up the road here. I mean, it really was going to look bad. And I started to buy ICI, only small amounts. And I bought sort of 500 shares every time they dropped something like 20p. And I had a few thousand, and I remember that Christmas that I came in, and the big story on the papers and around the market was that Burma was going to go bust. And I couldn't believe it was like Rolls-Royce again, and I thought, my God, if they go bust, we really are going to tip below the top. And I sold all my shares, and that really was the bottom of that sump. It really was the moment that you should hang on, and I sold everything personally, and it was a disaster. But it was just like Rolls-Royce. Mm. It really was. I thought, my God, I must salvage something, and that was the bottom of the market. Still, you learn these things, don't you? These are part of sort of growing up, I suppose.
Now, what were these conditions like for jobbing and for jobbers, say, the 70s, when values were just simply falling away?
Bad. Yeah. Very difficult. Mm. I mean, it really was. Some days were interminably long. You couldn't believe that you weren't dealing. I mean, we were very few bargains, and obviously we didn't want positions. It was tough. It really was tough. I mean, it was so tough that I actually started up a little business outside. I mean, we were, fortunately, I think people were very good, mostly because we were locked in as partners, if you like, and you sank or swam together. But firms, by and large, it wasn't a massive across-the-board cutting of jobs. Although a lot of people did go, natural wastage came in, lots of people in the stock exchange went out to banks. We lost a lot of people in the industry. But I don't remember sort of wholesale sackings, just people going, no bonuses, of course. But lots of my contemporaries had become partners in the previous few years. And so what could they do? I mean, they were locked in. They had a little bit of capital by that time. And really, one had to have belief in the fact there was a future, otherwise you'd have just eroded your capital completely. Mm. I think we were pretty good at keeping our expenses down. That was because there were no bonuses, and because, apart from lunch and vouchers, there weren't any real niceties. Mm. So I think we kept the expenses down, but the fact of the matter was that things were tough, and I did actually go out, and I used to go up to the Caledonia markets. I used to deal in bric-a-brac and things like that, and we bought a little shop, my wife and myself, in the New King's Road, and we turned that into a little sort of antique shop. And I remember very well getting up before coming to the city and going to Portobello at sort of 5 in the morning, and then going out to buy stock in the evening, and And what was particularly significant then was I remember going down to the Valence Road, which is a road that, if you like, totters used, and it was behind Petticoat Lane, and we used to go down there at sort of 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and you start at one end of this road, and it was pitch dark, and you had torches, and you'd be buying all your bits and pieces and take it back to your car. And I very well remember seeing lots of my contemporaries coming the other way, you know, they're doing the same thing. And one particular chap called Patrick Quirk, who I've known all my life, I suppose, and he's only just recently left the Stock Exchange, but I remember very well that we were going up from the far end, and as dawn broke, and we'd been buying some bits and pieces and tables and chairs and so on, coming the other way was this guy, Patrick Quirk, and he was selling carpet squares. I remember that so well. And when we see each other now, we're always pulling a leg. He's always pulling my leg because he said, "You promised me that 6 chairs and 2 carvers all that time ago, Brian, you never delivered, you know." Mm. But he literally was selling carpet squares and making a living that way. I mean, he was still on the Stock Exchange, but the things were grim. Mm. I mean, really, you just had to supplement your income, you know. And I ran that for a few years, that little shop, and rather strange, my first customer when I was running that, he now owns it. Mm. And it's still going in New King's Road. Mm. He's a great pal of ours, actually. Mm.
Now, what was it like trading when everyone must have seemed to be a seller? How did you go about?
Well,